This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents On Grand Strategy by John Lewis Gaddis. Read for you by Mike Chamberlain. 4. Nicholas F. Brady, 1952. Charles B. Johnson, 1954. And Henry Sam Chauncey, Jr., 1957. Grand Strategists. Preface. The title, I know, risks raising eyebrows. But my Yale History Department colleague, Timothy Snyder, has preceded me on tyranny, as has, more distantly, Seneca, on the shortness of life. I'm most worried, though, about admirers of Carl von Clausewitz, being one myself. His posthumously published On War, 1832, set the standard for all subsequent writing on that subject and its necessary corollary, grand strategy. My justification for yet another such book is concision, not one of Clausewitz's strengths. On Grand Strategy covers more years than On War, but at less than half the length. It grows out of two experiences with grand strategy, separated by a quarter century. The first was teaching strategy and policy at the United States Naval War College from 1975 to 1977, under circumstances described at the end of Chapter 2. The second has been co-teaching Yale University's Studies in Grand Strategy seminar every year from 2002 to the present. Both courses have always relied more on classical texts and historical case studies than on theory. The single-semester Newport seminars, however, are chiefly for mid-career military officers. The two-semester Yale course recruits undergraduate, graduate, and professional school students, as well as, each year, an active-duty Army and Marine Corps lieutenant colonel. Both courses are collaboratively taught, normally one civilian and one military instructor for each seminar section at Newport, and, at Yale, varying combinations. My colleagues Charles Hill, Paul Kennedy, and I began as a troika, attending all classes, arguing with one another in front of the students, and individually advising them, not always consistently, outside of class. Remarkably, we're still neighbors and close friends. My colleagues have taught me a lot. Another reason I feel obliged now to try to say what I've learned. I've done so in a way that's informal, impressionistic, and wholly idiosyncratic. My teachers bear no responsibility other than for setting me off on paths they couldn't control. Because I seek patterns across time, space, and scale, I felt free to suspend such constraints for comparative, even conversational purposes. St. Augustine and Machiavelli will occasionally talk with one another, as will Clausewitz and Tolstoy, who is, in turn, the imaginer I've found most helpful. Others include Virgil, Shakespeare, and F. Scott Fitzgerald. Finally, I've returned often to the ideas of Sir Isaiah Berlin, whom I got to know slightly while visiting the University of Oxford in 1992 to 93. I hope he'd be pleased to be considered a grand strategist. I know he'd be amused. The dedication celebrates the two great benefactors of our program, along with one wise facilitator. Their vision, generosity, and unvarying good advice, not least that we teach common sense, have been our anchor, our compass, and the vessel itself in which we sail. JLG, New Haven, Connecticut, Fall 2017. Chapter 1. Crossing the Hellespont. The date is 480 BCE. The place is Abydos, the town on the Asian side of the Hellespont, where it narrows to just over a mile in width. The scene is worthy of Hollywood in its heyday. Xerxes, Persia's king of kings, ascends a throne on a promontory from which he can see armies assembled, the historian Herodotus tells us, of over 1.5 million men. Had the number been only a tenth of that, as is more likely, it would still have approximated the size of Eisenhower's forces on D-Day in 1944. The Hellespont has no bridge now, but Xerxes had two then. One rested on 360 boats lashed together, the other on 314, both curved to accommodate winds and currents. For after an earlier bridge had broken apart in a storm, the furious king beheaded the builders and ordered the waters themselves whipped and branded. Somewhere on the bottom there presumably lie, to this day, the iron fetters he had thrown in for good measure. On that day, though, the waters are calm, and Xerxes is content, until he bursts into tears. His advisor and uncle, Artabanus, asks why. "Here are all these thousands," the king replies, "and not one of them will be alive 100 years from now." Artabanus consoles his master by reminding him of all the calamities that can make life intolerable and death a relief. Xerxes acknowledges this, but demands, "Tell me the very truth." Would Artabanus have favored the task at hand, a second Persian invasion of Greece in just over a decade, had they not both had the same frightening dream? Now it's Artabanus who shudders. "I am still full, nay, overfull, of fear." Xerxes' dream had come twice after Artabanus dissuaded him from avenging the Greeks' humiliation of Darius, Xerxes' father, at Marathon 10 years earlier. As if in anticipation of Hamlet, still 2 millennia into the future, an apparition, regal in aspect, paternal in attitude, had issued an ultimatum. "If you do not launch your war at once, just as a short while raised you to be great and mighty, so with speed again shall you be humble." Artabanus at first scoffed at the dream's significance, whereupon Xerxes made him trade clothes and sleep in the royal bed. The specter reappeared, so terrifying Artabanus that he woke up screaming, instantly urging the new invasion. Xerxes then gave the orders. The great force gathered at Sardis, sacrificed 1,000 heifers at the ruins of Troy, arrived at the Hellespont, found the bridges ready, and was preparing to cross them when the king allowed his uncle one last chance to voice whatever reservations he might yet have. Artabanus, despite his nightmare, can't resist. "The enemies ahead," he warns, "will not just be Greeks, formidable fighters though they are. They'll also include the land and the sea. The march around the Aegean will traverse territories incapable of feeding so large an army. There won't be enough harbors to shelter ships if storms arise. Exhaustion, even starvation, could set in before fighting a single battle." The prudent leader dreads and reflects on everything that can happen to him, but is bold when he is in the thick of action. Xerxes listens patiently, but objects that, "If you were to take account of everything, you would never do anything. It is better to have a brave heart and endure 1/2 of the terrors we dread than to calculate all of the terrors and suffer nothing at all. Big things are won by big dangers." That settles it. Xerxes sends Artabanus back to rule the existing empire, while turning his own attention to doubling its extent. He prays to the sun for the strength to conquer not just Greece, but all of Europe. He has myrtle branches strewn before the bridges. He orders his priests to burn incense. And he rewards the Hellespont by pouring into it a libation, followed by the golden cup that contained it, followed by the golden bowl in which it was mixed, followed as well by a sword. This clears the way for the crossing, which takes 7 days and nights to complete. As Xerxes himself reaches the European shore, an awed bystander is heard asking why Zeus has disguised himself as the Persian monarch, bringing along all the people of the world. Could the god not have destroyed Greece on his own? 1. 2,419 years later, an Oxford don took a break from tutorials to go to a party. 30 at the time, Isaiah Berlin had been born in Riga, brought up in St. Petersburg, and, after witnessing the Bolshevik Revolution at the age of 8, emigrated with his family to England. There he thrived, mastering the new language through a thicket of accents that never left him, triumphing in his Oxford examinations, and becoming the first Jew ever elected to an All Souls College Fellowship. By 1939, he was teaching philosophy at New College, established in 1379, developing an aversion to logical positivism, nothing means anything without reproducible verification, and hugely enjoying life. A glittering conversationalist with a sponge-like thirst for ideas, Berlin relished opportunities to show himself off and to soak things up. At this party, the exact date isn't known, he ran into Julian Edward George Asquith, the second Earl of Oxford and Asquith, then finishing a classics degree at Balliol. Lord Oxford had come across an intriguing line from the ancient Greek poet Archilochus of Paros. It was, as Berlin remembered it, "The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing." The passage survives only as a fragment, so its context has long been lost. But the Renaissance scholar Erasmus played around with it, and Berlin couldn't help doing the same. Might it become a scheme for classifying great writers? If so, Plato, Dante, Dostoevsky, Nietzsche, and Proust would all have been hedgehogs. Aristotle, Shakespeare, Goethe, Pushkin, and Joyce were obviously foxes. So was Berlin, who distrusted most big things, like logical positivism, but felt fully at ease with smaller ones. Diverted by World War II, Berlin didn't return to his quadrupeds until 1951, when he used them to frame an essay he was preparing on Tolstoy's philosophy of history. It appeared 2 years later as a short book, The Hedgehog and the Fox. Hedgehogs, Berlin explained, relate everything to a single central vision through which all that they say and do has significance. Foxes, in contrast, pursue many ends, often unrelated and even contradictory, connected, if at all, only in some de facto way. The distinction was simple, but not frivolous. It offered a point of view from which to look and compare, a starting point for genuine investigation. It might even reflect one of the deepest differences which divide writers and thinkers, and, it may be, human beings in general. Having fired off that flare, however, Berlin failed to illuminate much with it beyond Tolstoy. The great man had wanted to be a hedgehog, Berlin claimed. War and peace was supposed to reveal the laws by which history worked. But Tolstoy was too honest to neglect the peculiarities of personality and the contingencies of circumstance that defy such generalizations. So he filled his masterpiece with some of the most fox-like writing in all literature, mesmerizing his readers, who happily skipped the hedgehog-like history ruminations scattered throughout the text. Torn by contradictions, Tolstoy approached death, Berlin concluded, a desperate old man, beyond human aid, wandering self-blinded like Oedipus at Colonus. Biographically, this was too simple. Tolstoy did die in an obscure Russian railway station in 1910 and at the age of 82, after abandoning his home and family. It's unlikely that he did so, though, regretting loose ends left decades earlier in War and Peace. Nor is it clear that Berlin evoked Oedipus for any deeper purpose than to end his essay with a dramatic flourish. Perhaps too dramatic, for it suggested irreconcilable differences between foxes and hedgehogs. You had to be one or the other, Berlin seemed to be saying. You couldn't be both and be happy, or effective, or even whole. Berlin was therefore surprised, but puckishly pleased, when his creatures went viral, long before there was an internet to help them along. References began proliferating in print. Cartoons appeared, requiring no explanation. And in university classrooms, professors began asking their students, was X, who could be any historical or literary figure, a fox or a hedgehog? Students began asking their professors, is it better, at this or any other moment, to be a hedgehog or a fox? Both began asking themselves, where, within this polarity, should I seek to be? And then, can I stay there? And finally, who, in the end, am I? By way of an Oxford party, an Archilochus fragment, and Tolstoy's epic, Berlin had stumbled upon two of the very best ways to become intellectually indelible. The first is to be Delphic, a trick known to oracles throughout time. The second is to be Aesopian. Turn your ideas into animals, and they'll achieve immortality. 2. Herodotus, who lived from the 480s to the 420s BCE, may have known Archilochus, circa 680 to 645, on foxes and hedgehogs. He cites the poet in another context, and so could have seen the poem, if still extant, in which they first appeared. Even if he didn't, it's hard to read Herodotus' account of Artabanus and Xerxes at the Hellespont without sensing, in the advisor, an uneasy fox, and, in the monarch, an unapologetic hedgehog. Artabanus stresses prices to be paid, in energy expended, in supplies stretched, in communications compromised, in morale weakened, in everything else that can go wrong, when seeking to move any large force across any body of land or water. Success requires taking on too much. Does Xerxes not see that the god strikes with lightning only those who attempt big things, while the little ones do not itch the god to action? Dismantle the bridges, disband the armies, and send everybody back home, Artabanus urges, where the worst that can await them will be more bad dreams. Xerxes, who weeps for the dead 100 years hence, has a larger and longer view. If death is the price of life, why not pay the lesser prices that make lives memorable? Why be a forgettable king of kings? Having tamed the Hellespont, he can hardly stop. The bridges have to lead somewhere. Great militaries carry all they need to ensure that what can go wrong won't, or that if it does, it won't matter. It is the god that leads us on, and so, when we of ourselves set about our many enterprises, we prosper. Artabanus respects environments, knowing that landscapes can help or hinder an army, that fleets never fully control the seas on which they sail, that weather is beyond any mortal's capacity to predict. Commanders must distinguish where they can act from what they must accept, trusting only in such craft as circumstances allow. Xerxes, in contrast, reshapes environments. He turns water into, more or less, solid ground by bridging the Hellespont. He makes solid ground liquid by cutting a canal across the Athos Peninsula, out of mere arrogance, Herodotus tells us, so his ships won't have to sail around it. The king doesn't worry about what he'll have to accept, because he'll flatten whatever gets in the way. And he trusts only the divine hand that's entrusted him with such power. The short-sighted Artabanus sees so much on the immediate horizon that complexity itself is the enemy. The far-sighted Xerxes sees only a distant horizon on which ambitions are opportunities. Simplicity is the searchlight that shows the way. Artabanus keeps changing his mind. His twists and turns are meant, like those of Odysseus, to get him home. Xerxes, in crossing the Hellespont, becomes Achilles. He'll have no home other than in the tales the future will tell of the deeds he has done. This fox and this hedgehog, therefore, find no common ground. With his warnings unheeded, Artabanus heads east from Abydos and out of Herodotus, who makes no further mention of him. Xerxes moves west, taking his armies, his navy, and his historian with him, as well as all subsequent chroniclers of the Persian invasion. The Hellespont, a boundary between continents, now also separates the two ways of thinking that Archilochus anticipated, that Berlin would make famous, and that a late 20th century feat of social science would still more sharply define. 3. In an effort to determine the roots of accuracy and inaccuracy in forecasting, the American political psychologist Philip E. Tetlock and his assistants collected 27,451 predictions on world politics between 1988 and 2003 from 284 experts in universities, governments, think tanks, foundations, international institutions, and the media. Replete with tables, graphs, and equations, Tetlock's 2005 book, Expert Political Judgment, reports the findings of this most rigorous study ever done on why some people get the future right and others don't. Who experts were, professional background, status, and so on, made scarcely an iota of difference, Tetlock concludes. Nor did what experts thought, whether they were liberals or conservatives, realists or institutionalists, optimists or pessimists. But how experts thought, their style of reasoning, did matter. The critical variable turned out to be self-identification as foxes or hedgehogs when shown Berlin's definitions of those terms. The results were unequivocal. Foxes were far more proficient predictors than hedgehogs, whose record approximated that of a dart-throwing and presumably computer-simulated chimpanzee. Startled by this outcome, Tetlock sought what distinguished his foxes from his hedgehogs. The foxes relied, for their predictions, on an intuitive stitching together of diverse sources of information, not on deductions derived from grand schemes. They doubted that the cloud-like subject of politics could ever be the object of a clock-like science. The best of them shared a self-deprecating style of thinking that elevated no thought above criticism. But they tended to be too discursive, too inclined to qualify their claims, to hold an audience. Talk show hosts rarely invited them back. Policymakers found themselves too busy to listen. Tetlock's hedgehogs, in contrast, shunned self-deprecation and brushed aside criticism. Aggressively deploying big explanations, they displayed a bristly impatience with those who do not get it. When the intellectual holes they dug got too deep, they'd simply dig deeper. They became prisoners of their preconceptions, trapped in cycles of self-congratulation. These played well as sound bites, but bore little relationship to what subsequently occurred. All of which suggested, to Tetlock, a theory of good judgment, that self-critical thinkers are better at figuring out the contradictory dynamics of evolving situations, more circumspect about their forecasting prowess, more accurate in recalling mistakes, less prone to rationalize those mistakes, more likely to update their beliefs in a timely fashion, and, as a cumulative result of these advantages, better positioned to affix realistic probabilities in the next round of events. In short, foxes do it better. 4. The test of a good theory lies in its ability to explain the past, for only if it does can we trust what it may tell us about the future. Tetlock's past, however, was the decade and a half in which he ran his experiment. Herodotus offers an opportunity to apply Tetlock's findings, admittedly without his careful controls, to an age far removed from our own. They hold up across this distance surprisingly well. After crossing the Hellespont, Xerxes advanced, confident that the size of his forces and the opulence of his entourage would make resistance futile. Even if all the Greeks, and moreover all the men who live in the western countries, were assembled together, they would not be able to fight me. The king's plan seemed to be working as he proceeded through Thrace, Macedonia, and Thessaly, but his progress, necessarily, was very slow. His army was so large that it drank rivers and lakes dry before all of its units could get to the other side. Lions, still flourishing in the region, developed a taste for the camels carrying his supplies. And Xerxes was exhausting the capacity of even cooperative Greeks to meet his culinary requirements. One gave thanks that the king ate only once a day, for if his city had been asked to provide breakfast on the scale of the dinner Xerxes demanded, its inhabitants must either have fled or been ground to dust, worse than any people on earth had ever been. Nor could Xerxes flatten all topography. The Persians, to enter Attica, would have to march through the narrow pass at Thermopylae, and it was there that Leonidas' Spartans, a far inferior force hastily recruited, delayed the invaders for several days. Neither Leonidas nor his elite 300 survived, but their refusal to surrender showed that Xerxes could no longer rely on intimidation alone to get what he wanted. Meanwhile, late summer storms in the Aegean were battering his fleet, while the Athenians, following the orders of their admiral general, Themistocles, were evacuating their city. This left Xerxes with Napoleon's dilemma at Moscow in 1812. What do you do when you've captured your objective, only to find it abandoned and bad weather on the way? The King of Kings fell back, characteristically, upon still more intimidation. He burned the Acropolis, and then mounted another throne atop another promontory overlooking another body of water from which to witness what remained of his navy complete his triumph. Surely smoke rising from their holiest temple would demoralize the Athenian citizen rowers. But the bay was Salamis, the triremes were trained, and the Delphic oracle had promised safety behind wooden walls, presumably the kind that floated. So, as Xerxes watched, the Greeks sent his fleet to the bottom and slaughtered the survivors, who, in any event, hadn't been taught how to swim. The king had no choice now but to accept, much too belatedly, his uncle's advice to return home. Themistocles hastened the king's departure by spreading the rumor that the Hellespont bridges would be the Athenians' next target. Terrified, Xerxes hastened to get back across, leaving his demoralized armies to fend for themselves. The Greeks then defeated them at Plataea, but left further retribution, imaginatively, to a playwright. Aeschylus, the Persians, first performed 8 years after Salamis, depicts the bedraggled Xerxes limping into his own capital to the lamentations of all who'd earlier acclaimed him, and to this warning from the chastened ghost of Darius. Never, being mortal, ought we cast our thoughts too high. Herodotus drew on Aeschylus for his history. Could he have also, for his account of the dreams, evoking Darius' spirit, if not his ghost, that drove Xerxes to the Hellespont in the first place? There's no way to know for sure. Spirits are shadowy things. But it's fun to imagine this particular shadow, whoever he represented, using his supernatural powers to zoom forward in time to absorb and then take back to the now disconsolate King of Kings, Professor Tetlock's warning about how often foxes are right and hedgehogs are chumps. 5. Xerxes' invasion of Greece was an early but spectacular example of hedgehog-like behavior. Being King of Kings was a very big thing. If Xerxes could gather the greatest military force ever while turning water into land at the Hellespont and land into water on the Athos Peninsula, then what couldn't he do? Why not, after conquering Greece, all of Europe? Why not, he even asked himself at one point, a Persian empire that has the same limit as Zeus's sky? But Xerxes failed, as is the habit of hedgehogs, to establish a proper relationship between his ends and his means. Because ends exist only in the imagination, they can be infinite. A throne on the moon, perhaps, with a great view. Means, though, are stubbornly finite. They're boots on the ground, ships in the sea, and the bodies required to fill them. Ends and means have to connect if anything is to happen. They're never, however, interchangeable. The only constraints Xerxes imposed on capabilities were his own aspirations. He hoped for the best, assuming that it would be the worst. He lived only in the present, cutting himself off from the past, where experience resided, and from the future, where the unforeseen lurked. Had Xerxes grasped these distinctions, he'd have seen that his armies and fleets could never have transported all that it would take just to invade Greece. Unless the king could induce those he was invading to supply his invasion, not easy, his own men, although probably not himself, would soon begin to get hungry or thirsty or tired. Resistance by a few, as at Thermopylae, would shake the confidence of many, and winter would be coming on. There would have been risks, too, though, in following the fox-like Artabanus. He could have warned Xerxes of the depleted rivers, hungry lions, sudden squalls, resentful locals, fierce fighters, cryptic oracles, avid rowers, and sinking non-swimmers awaiting him across the Hellespont. Because their causes were knowable, their consequences were predictable. But only individually, for not even the canniest seer can specify cumulative effects. Little things add up in unpredictably big ways, and yet leaders can't let uncertainties paralyze them. They must appear to know what they're doing, even when they don't. Xerxes carried this principle to a ferocious extreme. When Pythias the Lydian provided all the troops and treasure the king had requested for the invasion, save only the service of his eldest son, Xerxes found a way to show, unforgettably, his resolve. He had the young men bisected, and then ordered his armies to march between the bloody halves. That left no doubt as to Xerxes' determination, but this literal red line locked him in. He couldn't have rethought his plans now, even if he'd wanted to. The tragedy of Xerxes and Artabanus is that each lacked the other's proficiency. The king, like Tetlock's hedgehogs, commanded the attention of audiences, but tended to dig himself into holes. The advisor, like Tetlock's foxes, avoided the holes, but couldn't retain audiences. Xerxes was right. If you try to anticipate everything, you'll risk not accomplishing anything. But so was Artabanus. If you fail to prepare for all that might happen, you'll ensure that some of it will. 6. Neither Xerxes nor Artabanus, therefore, would have passed F. Scott Fitzgerald's test from 1936 for a first-rate intelligence, the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. Fitzgerald may have intended nothing more than a reproach to himself. His writing career had stalled by then, and 4 years later he would die of alcoholism, heart disease, and an obscurity made all the more painful by his earlier fame. He was only 44. But the cryptic capaciousness of his aphorism, like Berlin's on foxes and hedgehogs, has made it immortal. The Delphic Oracle would have been envious. One possible meaning for Fitzgerald's opposites could be taking the best from contradictory approaches while rejecting the worst, precisely the compromise that Xerxes and Artabanus failed to reach 24 centuries earlier. How, though, might you do that? It's easy to see how two minds can reach opposite conclusions, but can opposites coexist peacefully within one? They certainly didn't in Fitzgerald's, whose life was as tortured as Tolstoy's, and half the length. The best answer to this question comes, paradoxically, from Berlin, who devoted much of his longer and happier life to reconciling conflicts within single minds. Ordinary experience, he pointed out, is filled with ends equally ultimate, the realization of some of which must inevitably involve the sacrifice of others. The choices facing us are less often between stark alternatives, good versus evil, for instance, than between good things we can't have simultaneously. One can save one's soul, or one can found or maintain or serve a great and glorious state, Berlin wrote, but not always both at once. Or, to put it in terms any kid would understand, you can't gobble all your treats on Halloween without throwing up. We resolve these dilemmas by stretching them over time. We seek certain things now, put off others until later, and regard still others as unattainable. We select what fits where, and then decide which we can achieve when. The process can be difficult. Berlin emphasized the necessity and agony of choice. But if such choices were to disappear, he added, so too would the freedom to choose, and hence liberty itself. What then of Berlin's claim in his Tolstoy essay that foxes and hedgehogs divide human beings in general? Must we define ourselves as one or the other, as Tetlock asked his experts to do? Berlin admitted, shortly before his death, that this wasn't necessary. Some people are neither foxes nor hedgehogs. Some people are both. He'd just been playing an intellectual game. Others took it too seriously. The explanation made sense within the larger framework of Berlin's thought. For what choices would we have if stuck within categories, mimicking animals, that mandated predictability? If, as Fitzgerald argued, intelligence requires opposites, if freedom is choosing, as Berlin maintained, then priorities can't be predetermined. They'd have to reflect who we are, but also what we're experiencing. The first we could know in advance, but not always the second. We'd need to combine, within a single mind, our own, the hedgehog's sense of direction, and the fox's sensitivity to surroundings, while retaining the ability to function. 7. Where, though, other than as a garbled Jane Austen title, might we find such sense and sensitivity? She offers a hint, for only narratives can show dilemmas across time. It's not enough to display choices like slivers on a microscope slide. We need to see change happen, and we can do that only by reconstituting the past as histories, biographies, poems, plays, novels, or films. The best of these sharpen and shade simultaneously. They compress what's happening in order to clarify, even as they blur, the line between instruction and entertainment. They are, in short, dramatizations. And a fundamental requirement of these is never to bore. Steven Spielberg's 2012 film Lincoln is dramatization at its best. It shows the president, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, trying to make good on the claim in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. What more praiseworthy cause could a hedgehog possibly pursue? But to abolish slavery, Lincoln must move the 13th Amendment through a fractious House of Representatives, and here his maneuvers are as foxy as they come. He resorts to deals, bribes, flattery, arm-twisting, and outright lies, so much so that the movie reeks, visually, if not literally, of smoke-filled rooms. When Thaddeus Stevens, Tommy Lee Jones, asks the president how he can reconcile so noble an aim with such malodorous methods, Lincoln recalls what his youthful years as a surveyor taught him. A compass will point you true north from where you're standing, but it's got no advice about the swamps and deserts and chasms that you'll encounter along the way. If in pursuit of your destination, you plunge ahead, heedless of obstacles, and achieve nothing more than to sink in a swamp, then what's the use of knowing true north? I had the spooky sense, when I saw the film, that Berlin was sitting next to me, and at the conclusion of this scene leaned over to whisper triumphantly, "You see, Lincoln knows when to be a hedgehog, consulting the compass, and when a fox, skirting the swamp." The real Lincoln, as far as I know, never said any of this, and the real Berlin, sadly, never got to see Spielberg's film. But Tony Kushner's screenplay shows Fitzgerald's linkage of intelligence, opposing ideas, and the ability to function. Lincoln keeps long-term aspirations and immediate necessities in mind at the same time. It reconciles Berlin's foxes and hedgehogs with his insistence on the inevitability and the unpredictability of choice. Lincoln can't know what deals he'll have to cut until he's seen what the previous ones have accomplished. And the film repeatedly connects big things with little ones. Lincoln understands that the vote in the House, and hence the future of slavery in America, may well depend on who gets to be postmaster in some village somewhere. Spielberg's Lincoln, therefore, shows actions taken across time, Berlin, the coexistence of opposites within a space, Fitzgerald, and a shifting of scale that echoes, why not Tolstoy? For both Lincolns, the one portrayed and the one who lived, grasped intuitively what Tolstoy tried to convey in his own colossal dramatization, War and Peace, that everything relates to everything else. Perhaps that's why the great novelist, who rarely saw greatness in any leader, accorded that accolade posthumously to the martyred president. 8. The shifts of scale that take place in War and Peace still startle its readers. Tolstoy places us within the mind of Natasha at her first grand ball, within that of Pierre as he gets himself into and survives a duel, within those of Prince Bolkonski and Count Rostov, the most difficult and indulgent fathers in modern literature. Yet Tolstoy zooms out from these intimacies to show us armies sweeping across Europe, then back into focus on the emperors and officers who commanded them, then further in to portray the ordinary soldiers who lived, marched, and fought in them. He zooms out again after Borodino to show Moscow in flames, then in again to depict refugees from the burning city, among whom is the grievously wounded Prince Andrei, who dies in the arms of Natasha, with whom he'd fallen in love, 3 years and hundreds of pages earlier at her first grand ball. Whether we approach reality from the top down or the bottom up, Tolstoy seems to be saying, an infinite number of possibilities exist at an indeterminate number of levels, all simultaneously. Some are predictable, most aren't, and only dramatization, free from the scholar's enslavement to theory and archives, can begin to represent them. But ordinary people, much of the time, manage nonetheless to make sense of them. Berlin tried to explain how in his Tolstoy essay. History, only history, only the sum of the concrete events in time and space, the sum of the actual experience of actual men and women in their relation to one another and to an actual three-dimensional, empirically experienced, physical environment, this alone contained the truth, the material out of which genuine answers, answers needing for their apprehension no special sense or faculties which normal human beings did not possess, might be constructed. The passage is convoluted even for Berlin, who rarely saw simplicity as a virtue. But I think he's describing here an ecological sensitivity that equally respects time, space, and scale. Xerxes never had it, despite Artabanus's efforts. Tolstoy approximated it, if only in a novel. But Lincoln, who lacked an Artabanus and who didn't live to read War and Peace, seems somehow to have achieved it by way of a common sense that's uncommon among great leaders. 9. I mean, by common sense, the ease with which most of us manage, most of the time. We generally know where we're going, but we're constantly adjusting our route to avoid the unexpected, including obstructions others place in our path while on their way to wherever they're going. My own students, for example, skillfully avoid collisions with lampposts, alarmed professors, and similarly preoccupied peers, while compulsively consulting electronic devices permanently attached, it seems, to a hand or an ear. Not all of us are that agile, but there's nothing unusual about the simultaneous presence within our minds of a short-term sensitivity to surroundings and a long-term sense of direction. We live with these opposites every day. The psychologist Daniel Kahneman attributes this proficiency to an unconscious reliance on two kinds of thinking. Fast thinking is intuitive, impulsive, and often emotional. It produces, when needed, instant action. It's what you do to keep from running into things or to keep them from running into you. Slow thinking is deliberate, focused, and usually logical. It needn't result in action at all. It's how you learn in order to know. Tetlock sees a similarity in the human genome and uses Berlin's animals to explain it. Foxes were better equipped to survive in rapidly changing environments in which those who abandoned bad ideas quickly held the advantage. Hedgehogs were better equipped to survive in static environments that rewarded persisting with tried-and-true formulas. Our species, Homo sapiens, is better off for having both temperaments. We may owe our existence, then, to the dexterity with which we switch between fast and slow thinking, between the behavior of foxes and that of hedgehogs. For if we'd never gone beyond regarding ourselves as only one big thing, we'd have wound up not just in one of Lincoln's swamps, but with the mammoths in their tar pits. Why, though, don't those in authority match this flexibility? How, at one end of history, could Xerxes and Artabanus have seen so little need for it? How, at the other end, could Tetlock's experts so readily have identified themselves as either foxes or hedgehogs, but not both? And why should we regard Lincoln's leadership as extraordinary if all he did was what ordinary people do every day? Common sense, in this sense, is like oxygen. The higher you go, the thinner it gets. With great power comes great responsibility, Spider-Man's Uncle Ben reminded him memorably, but also the danger of doing dumb things. 10. Which is what grand strategy is meant to prevent. I'll define that term, for the purposes of this book, as the alignment of potentially unlimited aspirations with necessarily limited capabilities. If you seek ends beyond your means, then sooner or later you'll have to scale back your ends to fit your means. Expanding means may attain more ends, but not all, because ends can be infinite and means can never be. Whatever balance you strike, there'll be a link between what's real and what's imagined, between your current location and your intended destination. You won't have a strategy until you've connected these dots, dissimilar though they are, within the situation in which you're operating. Where, then, does the adjective grand come in? It has to do, I think, with what's at stake. Your life as a student won't fundamentally change if you sleep for another 20 minutes tomorrow morning at the cost of grabbing a cold bagel instead of a hot breakfast on your way to class. The stakes rise, though, as you consider what you're learning in that class, how that relates to the other courses you're taking, what your major and then your degree are going to be, how you might parlay these into a profession, and with whom you may fall in love along the way. Strategies become grander even as they remain within the beholder's eye. It's wrong to say, then, that states have grand strategies, but that people don't. Alignments are necessary across time, space, and scale. Grand strategies have traditionally been associated, however, with the planning and fighting of wars. That's not surprising, given the fact the first recorded relationships of aspirations with capabilities arose from the need to conduct military operations. Put heads together, Homer has wise Nestor admonishing the Achaeans at a desperate moment in the long siege of Troy, if strategy's any use. The necessity for such alignment, however, goes back much further, probably to the first pre-human who figured out how to get something it wanted, using whatever means happened to be available. Short of life after death, the universal aspiration was surely survival. Beyond that, strategies effloresced, from so simple a task as finding food, shelter, and clothing, to such complex responsibilities as ruling great empires. Specifying success was never easy, but the finite nature of means helped. For although satisfaction, in the end, is a state of mind, achieving it requires real expenditures. It's in that fact that the need for alignment, and hence for strategy, has always arisen. 11. So is it possible to teach grand strategy, or at least the common sense that sustains it? If Lincoln, with as little formal education as any American president, learned what he needed to know from self-prescribed reading and self-assessed experience, can't we do the same? The simple answer is that Lincoln was a genius, and most of us aren't. Shakespeare, it appears, had no writing tutor. Does nobody else then need one? It's worth remembering also that Lincoln and Shakespeare had a lifetime to become who they were. Young people today don't, because society so sharply segregates general education, professional training, ascent within an organization, responsibility for it, and then retirement. This worsens a problem Henry Kissinger identified long ago, that the intellectual capital leaders accumulate prior to reaching the top is all they'll be able to draw on while at the top. There's less time now than Lincoln had to learn anything new. That leaves it to the academy to shape the minds of its students while it has their attention. But the academic mind is itself divided. A gap has opened between the study of history and the construction of theory, both of which are needed if ends are to be aligned with means. Historians, knowing that their field rewards specialized research, tend to avoid the generalizations upon which theories depend. They thereby deny complexity the simplicities that guide us through it. Theorists, keen to be seen as social scientists, seek reproducibility in results. That replaces complexity with simplicity in the pursuit of predictability. Both communities neglect relationships between the general and the particular, between universal and local knowledge, that nurture strategic thinking. And both, as if to add opacity to this insufficiency, too often write badly. There is an older way, though, in which history and theory have worked together. Machiavelli hints at it in the dedicatory letter to the prince, where he values nothing so much as the knowledge of the actions of great men learned by me from long experience with modern things and a continuous reading of ancient ones. This he has distilled into one small volume, meant to give you, his patron, Lorenzo de' Medici, the capacity to be able to understand in a very short time all that I, Machiavelli, have learned and understood in so many years and with so many hardships and dangers for myself. Karl von Clausewitz, in his monumental but incomplete classic, On War, develops Machiavelli's method more fully. History alone, he argues, is just a long string of stories. That doesn't mean they're useless, though, because theory, when conceived of as distillation, keeps you from having to listen to them all again. There isn't time for that when you're about to go into combat or any other fraught field of endeavor. But you can't just wander around either, like Tolstoy's Pierre at Borodino. This is where training comes in. The well-trained soldier will surely perform better than one with no preparation at all. But what is training, as Clausewitz understands it? It's being able to draw upon principles extending across time and space, so that you'll have a sense of what's worked before and what hasn't. You then apply these to the situation at hand. That's the role of scale. The result is a plan, informed by the past, linked to the present, for achieving some future goal. The engagement, however, won't in all respects follow the plan. Not only will its outcome depend on what the other side does, the known unknowns, of which former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld famously spoke, but it will also reflect unknown unknowns, which are all the things that can go wrong before you've even encountered an adversary. Together, these constitute what Clausewitz called friction, the collision of theory with reality about which Artabanus tried to warn Xerxes many centuries earlier at the Hellespont. The only solution, then, is to improvise. But this is not just making it up as you go along. Maybe you'll stick to the plan, maybe you'll modify it, maybe you'll scrap it all together. Like Lincoln, though, you'll know your compass heading, whatever the unknowns that lie between you and your destination. You'll have in your mind a range of options for dealing with these, based, as if from Machiavelli, upon hard-won lessons from those who've gone before. The rest is up to you. 12. Boats crossing the Hellespont these days still connect battlefields, as Xerxes' bridges once did. Troy lies just to the south on the Asian side. Gallipoli, on the European, is even closer. Now the vessels are ferries, though, and the armies they transport are tourists, taking advantage of the fact that 30 centuries separate sites only about 30 miles apart. There's even time, in a single day, to take in the Trojan horse at Chernakala. Not the real one, of course, but the prop left over from the 2004 Brad Pitt movie. The scene lacks the grandeur of what Xerxes saw from his promontory in 480 BCE, but it makes an important point. That combat experience is rarer even than in the recent past. For whatever reason, the fear that a world war could annihilate all its participants, the shift back to smaller wars that only partially engage societies conducting them, perhaps just good luck, fewer people find themselves on battlefields today fighting battles. The sightseers are taking over. Clausewitz's concept of training, however, retains its relevance. It's the best protection we have against strategies getting stupider as they become grander, a recurring problem in peace as well as war. It's the only way to combine the apparent opposites of planning and improvisation. To teach the common sense that comes from knowing when to be a hedgehog and when a fox. Where, though, if not in the military, and if only inadequately within the academy or on the job, can young people today get such an education? The Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton, the Duke of Wellington did not say, although as the Victorian era's principal supplier of epigrams, he certainly should have. For apart from war and preparation for war, it's in competitive athletics that the Clausewitzian combination of a distilled past, a planned present, and an uncertain future most explicitly come together. With fitness more fashionable now than in the age of the great Duke, there's more participation in games than ever before. But what does that get you, and what does it have to do with grand strategy? You learn to play the game by having a coach, literally a trainer, who does what drill instructors used to do when military service was mandatory. Teach the basics, build stamina, enforce discipline, encourage collaboration, show you how to fail and to recover from failure. Once the game begins, though, your coach can only shout or sulk from the sidelines. You and your teammates are on your own, Still, you'll all do better for having been coached. It's not for nothing that Coach